Further Adventures. We leave Odysseus and Penelope reunited by the hearth because that image allows us to tiptoe away, like Telemachus and Eurycleia, from a perfect scene of homecoming. Of course, things are never that simple. Homer's Odyssey ends with Odysseus and Telemachus visiting old Laertes, who is overjoyed to see his son alive and back on the island. The three generations now have to stand against the outraged relatives of the slaughtered suitors, bent on their revenge. Athena comes down to declare that those killings were divinely approved and that the fighting should stop. Zeus has commanded her to tell them to swear to a treaty, recognizing Odysseus as the rightful king of Ithaca. The Greek world is slowly moving from a time of divine covenant to a time of human treaties and contracts. But Odysseus's debt to Poseidon is not yet fully discharged. The price he has to pay for poking that stick in Polyphemus's eye is high indeed. If you recall, when he visited Hades, Tiresias told him, "Finally home, and in the bosom of your wife and son, scores settled and peace established at your hearth, you will immediately have to leave Ithaca, an oar on your shoulder, to search for the land whose people have never heard of the sea, who use no salt, have no understanding of ships or sailing, and do not so much as know what an oar is. When a stranger hails you there, points at the oar on your shoulder, and asks why you are carrying a winnowing fan, you are to plant the oar in the ground, make sacrifices to Poseidon, and as you make your way back home, to each of the 12 great gods in turn." Homer is of no use to us now. Instead, the major source for post-Homeric Odyssean doings is the Telegony, a lost manuscript of disputed authorship that tells the adventures of Telegonus, Odysseus's son by Circe. Only two lines of that poem survive. We know what it contained thanks to a chrestomathy, a kind of anthology of writings for the benefit of those learning a new language, by an unknown figure who goes by the name of Proclus. Telemachus means warrior far away, and Telegonus means born far away. Just as telephone, telecommunications, etc., all refer to remote or distant forms of transmission and reception. And Odysseus was nothing if not a remote father. To satisfy Poseidon, then, Odysseus leaves Ithaca and travels by foot to the land of the Thesprotians, where the business with the oar and the winnowing fan takes place, as directed by Tiresias. While there, he consorts for a number of years with Queen Callidice of Thesprotia, who bears him a son, Polypoetes. The Thesprotians then go to war with the neighbouring kingdom of the Brigoi, who have Ares on their side. Odysseus, with the help of Athena, of course, fights for the Thesprotians, but after much bloodshed, Apollo intervenes and declares the whole thing a draw. Callidice dies, and Odysseus finally departs, leaving Polypoetes to rule as king. Trying to present the Odyssey as a story of a faithful, loving husband yearning for his beloved wife is all very well, but given his propensity to father children by women beginning with C alone, Circe, Calypso, and now Callidice, which perhaps ironically means good judgment, we have to appraise Odysseus against standards of marital fidelity and monogamy rather different from our own. The Telegony next takes us to Aeaea, where Circe tells her son Telegonus, now a young man, who he is, the son of a great warrior hero, Odysseus of Ithaca, the schemer, the wanderer, the winner of the Trojan War. Telegonus, like any young man of sense and spirit, is keen to leave the confines of his home island and explore the world. Circe gives him an enchanted spear, fashioned by Hephaestus himself. its tip is coated in stingray venom. To borrow a phrase of Thomas Hardy's, we now witness the convergence of the twain. Odysseus is returning to Ithaca, while Telegonus explores the wide seas. The boy finds himself, like his father before him so many times, washed up by a storm on an alien shore. He keeps body and soul together by killing a few cattle to eat. Odysseus arrives back home and finds a young man killing his cattle. A fight ensues. The envenomed spear pricks Odysseus, who falls back, mortally wounded. Telegonus discovers his opponent's identity and weeps over the dying Odysseus, who forgives him. Not quite the gentle death at sea at a prosperous old age that Tiresias foretold for Odysseus. Perhaps the stingray venom provides, rather shakily, the at-sea element, but it seems unlikely that the death it produces is gentle. Then a somewhat incredible pairing off ties the story in its final bow. Telegonus takes the body of Odysseus, along with Penelope and Telemachus, to his mother's island and the place of his birth, Aeaea. They bury Odysseus. Circe makes them all immortal. Telegonus marries Penelope, and Telemachus marries Circe. Thus, the mature women acquire fresh young sons of Odysseus to replace the original, and therefore, I suppose, they might be considered the winners. I used as an epigraph for this book the last two lines of the R.L. Stevenson poem Requiem. Given what we now know of Odysseus's death and burial, we could use the whole poem now for an epitaph. Under the wide and starry sky, dig the grave and let me lie. Glad did I live and gladly die, and I laid me down with a will. This be the verse you grave for me. Here he lies where he longed to be. Home is the sailor, home from sea, and the hunter, home from the hill. Perhaps Odysseus didn't long to be on Aeaea, but Circe certainly longed for him to be there. Immortals usually get their way. Meanwhile, what of Aeneas, whom we last saw sailing away from Carthage as the smoke rose from Dido's pyre? Virgil in the Aeneid, to some extent, mimics Homer, especially in Book 3 of his epic, having him face down Scylla and Charybdis, and even, like Odysseus, make a descent into the underworld in Book 6. There Aeneas confronts the shade of the inconsolable Dido and discovers what her love for him led her to do. His dead father, Anchises, gives him a vision of the great empire he is to found. Yet another one, I should say, the Aeneid is full of extravagant prophecies of the grandeur that will be Rome. Aeneas visits the island of the Cyclopes, where he hears the story of the blinding of Polyphemus from a man calling himself Achaemenides, who claims to be an Ithacan left behind by Odysseus, who, under the Roman name Ulysses, is presented as a hateful figure throughout the Aeneid. Aeneas, like Jason, has the doubtful pleasure of an encounter with the Harpies when he visits the Strophades, the Turning Islands. The second half of the poem is concerned with Aeneas and his Trojan party's settlement in Italy. King Latinus of Latium offers him his daughter Lavinia, plenty of La names. Juno's hatred of Aeneas has not diminished, still fearing that his Rome will one day defeat her Carthage. She incites Turnus of the neighbouring Rutuli to attack. After a series of engagements, betrayals, murders, and alliances, Aeneas stands over the defeated Turnus and administers the coup de grace. The ultimate victory of Troy over Greece through the foundation of Rome by the Trojan Aeneas is repeatedly referred to by Virgil throughout his epic as a victory of Asia over the Western Mediterranean. One of the epithets used for Aeneas is descendant of Dardanus, from whom come the Dardanelles. The Trojan Peninsula was then, as now, a gateway between continents. From the Trojan War, through the schism that moved the Roman Empire to Byzantium, the Crusades, the wars between Europe and the Ottoman Empire, paused, if not concluded, by the Great War, the area has always been an ethnical and geographical flashpoint. Much as Shakespeare wrote history plays to justify the Tudor dynasty's right to rule England, so Virgil wrote the Aeneid to justify the Julio-Claudian dynasty's right to rule Rome. The emperor, under whose pleasure he flourished, Augustus, was a great-nephew of Julius Caesar, who claimed descent all the way down to Aeneas. After defeating Mark Antony and Cleopatra, Augustus had declared himself Rome's first emperor, an act that shocked many. It needed to be vindicated before the public, and Virgil was the man to do it. He pulled off the clever trick of changing Aeneas' son's name, Ascanius, from Ilus, derived from Ilium, the other name for Troy, to Julus, which places him as a forebear of the gens Julia, the clan from which Augustus and the following Caesars descended. Though an entry in the Oxford Classical Dictionary states that actually the name of Julius for Ilus was written about by Cato the Elder, who preceded Virgil by almost 100 years. As an interesting sidebar, there grew up a legend, largely disseminated by the 12th century historian and cleric Geoffrey of Monmouth, that a descendant of Aeneas called Brutus went to a damp, foggy island somewhere north of France, defeated a race of giants there, and settled his own realm, which was named, after a slight corruption of Brutus, Britain. Rule Britannia.